December 11, 1474. High atop the Alcazar fortress in Madrid, King Enrique IV was dying. The King of Castile had been battling an unknown illness for nearly a year, and his condition was rapidly deteriorating.
He knew death was near, so he began to finalize his affairs. Jewels were to be sold to pay off his debts, and he wanted to be buried next to his mother.
But the topic on everyone's mind, who would inherit the kingdom?
At 2 a.m., Enrique closed his eyes and never opened them again. And with his last breath, the heir to the throne was still in question. Would it be Enrique's daughter Juana or his half-sister Isabella?
When Isabella learned of Enrique's death, she knew that this was her chance to seize the throne. For too long, she had been seen as nothing more than a bargaining chip for others. It was now her time to rule.
And she was more than willing to plunge Castile into war if it meant taking the crown.
Welcome to Dictators, a Parcast original. I'm Richard.
And I'm Kate. You can find all episodes of Dictators and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Dictators for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Dictators in the search bar.
Today we begin our look at the rise and reign of Queen Isabella I of Castile. From 1474 to 1504, she ruled over the Kingdom of Castile with her husband Ferdinand II of Aragon. During her time as queen, she helped create what is today modern Spain. She also kicked off the Age of Discovery by financing Christopher Columbus's maiden voyages.
However, what many don't know is that Isabella, a fierce proponent of Catholicism, initiated a bloody program to purge heretics from the kingdom. She was one of the leading architects of the Spanish Inquisition, the 300-year period of religious genocide that saw thousands of Jews, Muslims, and suspected heretics tortured and murdered, and all in the name of Catholicism.
This week, we'll explore Isabella's unlikely rise to the throne of Castile and how, upon taking power, she did what no man was able to accomplish: reclaim Granada from the Moors.
Next week, we'll dive into her role as one of the main proponents of the Spanish Inquisition, Columbus's famous 1492 voyage, and her battle to secure her legacy through her children.
Coming up, we'll explore the rise of Isabella I of Castile.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement.
Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Ghosts, UFOs, cryptids, life after death. You'll hear great thinkers on these subjects and more on the Paranormal Podcast, the longest running podcast of its type. I'm Jim Harold, and I invite you to join me as we explore the mysteries of life. I bet you love these topics just as much as I do, but don't worry, I won't tell anyone. Join me for some great paranormal conversation. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
15th century Europe was almost entirely dominated by men. They were kings, emperors, popes, and sultans. When a woman did become queen, rarely did it mean wielding power. Instead, she was merely a figurehead that bound kingdoms and families together.
The Christian kingdoms on the Iberian Peninsula, Castile, Aragon, and Portugal, were no different. In fact, since the fall of the Roman Empire, only two women held power in what is now called Spain.
Against this backdrop, Isabella of Castile wasn't supposed to be queen. And if European royal society wasn't already an obstacle on the road to the crown, the nature of her birth set the tone of things to come.
Unlike most royal births, Isabella's didn't receive the jubilation that was standard for princes or princesses. In fact, her father, King Juan II of Castile, made only a cursory announcement that at the end of April 1451, he now had a daughter.
Much of this was because when Isabella was born, she was automatically second in line to the throne. Despite her mother being the queen, an heir had already been chosen.
Isabella's half-brother, Enrique IV of Castile. Enrique was in his mid-20s in 1451 and already married. It was only a matter of time before he continued the line of succession with children of his own.
When Isabella was two, her younger brother Alfonso was born. Because he was male, he automatically superseded Isabella and pushed her to third in line. Destiny was relegating Isabella to the sidelines.
Isabella wasn't going to have a normal childhood, even by medieval standards. In 1454, her father died, meaning Enrique was now king. Isabella's mother sank into a deep depression that all but incapacitated her, making it impossible for her to care for Isabella or Alfonso. Instead, the young Isabella and Alfonso ended up in the care of their Portuguese grandmother in the town of Arévalo, about 40 miles from Segovia.
During this period, Isabella received an education befitting a princess. She learned to read and write, became versed in Spanish, Portuguese, Italian, and French, studied history and philosophy, and became an avid reader. But the most important discovery during her childhood was religion. Catholicism, essentially the only Western Christian religion at the time, became her foundation and encompassed all aspects of her life. Isabella found special inspiration in the recently martyred Joan of Arc.
Joan of Arc had been executed 20 years before Isabella was born. But in the early 1450s, Joan's trial was reevaluated in her favor. Soon, she became known as a religious icon throughout Europe, and for Isabella, a prime example of how one ought to fight for Christ.
Isabella knew that she would never go into battle herself, believing that combat was reserved only for men. However, Joan's militant devotion left a lasting effect on Isabella, for better or worse.
In 1461, 10-year-old Isabella and 7-year-old Alfonso were forced to leave their grandmother and live with their half-brother, King Enrique, and his wife, Queen Juana. The reason for the decision? To keep potential threats to his power nearby.
By now, King Enrique had earned the nickname the Impotent, since he had not produced an heir, male or female. Some in the court began to question if Enrique was even capable of procreating.
So when the queen suddenly became pregnant in 1461, many didn't believe that Enrique was the real father. These rumors scared Enrique. Isabella or Alfonso could use them to declare his child's claim to the throne as illegitimate and take power for themselves. Thus, Enrique decided to keep his perceived enemies even closer.
He took Isabella from her grandmother and made her a lady-in-waiting to Queen Juana. And although Isabella likened the queen to an evil stepmother, her time at the palace became a crash course in courtly life. The parties, the jousts, and the sexual politics played among kings, queens, and courtiers.
It was a total culture shock for the virtuous Catholic princess.
Worse yet, not long after Isabella moved to court, Enrique started looking for a foreign nobleman to marry Isabella. He needed alliances, and his half-sister was a valuable bargaining chip.
Enrique initially looked to pawn Isabella off to their cousin in the east, Prince Carlos of Aragon. But Carlos suddenly died, forcing Enrique to look elsewhere.
Enrique knew he needed to act quickly. His popularity among the people was plummeting. Throughout Castile, murder, assault, and robbery were suddenly on the rise. And with each passing day, the idea of swearing loyalty to a potentially illegitimate heir sickened many noblemen.
The two leaders of the dissent were men who were actually close to the king, Alfonso Carrillo da Cunha, Archbishop of Toledo, and Juan Pacheco, the Marqués of Villena. Both had their own private grievances with Enrique, but the common thread was that he had become a weak and ineffectual leader and needed to be replaced.
Both cast their eyes on Isabella's 11-year-old brother, Alfonso. In June 1465, the noblemen snatched Alfonso from Enrique's court and openly declared, "Castile for King Alfonso."
And with that, Castile was suddenly thrown into civil war. King Enrique looking to keep his crown, and Alfonso hoping to steal it.
For the next 3 years, the war consumed Castile. And for Isabella, who was forced to stay with Queen Juana, whoever won would dictate who she would marry and which alliances would be solidified.
Early on, both sides were locked in a stalemate. But in August 1467, fortune suddenly swung in Alfonso's favor at the Second Battle of Olmedo. Though both sides declared victory, 13-year-old Alfonso's valiant fighting inspired many Castilian noblemen to switch their support to him. A month later, Alfonso set his sights on Segovia, about 60 miles north of Madrid. Expecting yet another long battle, perhaps even a siege, Alfonso was shocked when the city's leaders opened their gates. Segovia, an important trading city, had fallen to the young usurper.
With her fate now in the hands of her younger brother, 16-year-old Isabella was forced to choose a side, Enrique or Alfonso.
Isabella was never close to Enrique. He had always seen her as a potential threat to his power. And even though Isabella wasn't considered an equal by the men backing Alfonso, at least she and Alfonso were personally close.
The choice was easy. She backed Alfonso.
The choice was everything Isabella could have hoped for. Not only did Alfonso reunite Isabella with their mother at the end of the year, but Isabella made the acquaintance of Gonzalo Fernandez de Córdoba.
Córdoba belonged to a prominent family in Castile that had supported Alfonso since the start of the Civil War. He and Isabella forged such a tight bond that in no time at all, he pledged his undying loyalty to her. She did the same.
But the reunion between brother and sister was cut short. In July 1468, 14-year-old Alfonso died of an unconfirmed illness. Some historians believe that he was stricken with the plague. Others theorize that he may have been poisoned by his enemies.
The death of Alfonso was a crushing blow for Isabella. Not only did she lose her closest ally, but once again, she was stuck in the company of men who only saw her as a political pawn.
Both of the war's instigators, Carrillo and Pacheco, wanted Isabella to declare herself queen and continue the civil war. While she was trying to grieve her brother's death, Isabella was faced with one of the most consequential decisions of her young life.
Call a truce with Enrique, or usurp him and become Queen of Castile.
Coming up, a secret marriage paves the way for the future of Spain. Hi, it's Kate. From trauma surgeons to hospice staff, we all know that medical professionals are trained to give exceptional care. But what about those who use their skills not to heal, but hurt? In the new podcast series, Medical Murders, you'll discover a disturbing diagnosis that not every doctor wants to extend your life. Every Wednesday, Medical Murders introduces you to the worst the medical community has to offer. Men and women who took an oath to save lives, but instead used their expertise to develop more sinister specialties. Join my dear friend, host Alastair Murden, as he examines the formative years and motives of history's most infamous killers, dissecting their medical backgrounds with expert analysis and professional insight provided by practicing MD, Dr. David Kipper. You'll investigate a wide range of heinous healthcare workers, like the general practitioner believed to be the most prolific serial killer in modern history, or the dentist who led a double life as a hitman, or even the doctor and gang member who mixed deadly potions for unhappy housewives to use on their husbands. When it comes to these true crime stories, the only thing the doctor ordered is murder. Follow Medical Murders free on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now back to the story.
In July 1468, 17-year-old Isabella of Castile was faced with a horrible dilemma. Still mourning the loss of her younger brother Alfonso, she was now being asked to continue the civil war against her older half-brother, King Enrique.
But Isabella was aware that the two men asking her to keep fighting, Juan Pacheco and Archbishop Alfonso Carrillo da Cunha, would only use her as a puppet to further their own careers. In all likelihood, even if she won the war, she would be powerless.
Faced with one of the first major decisions of her life, Isabella spent the next weeks in prayer. She knew whatever she decided could not only dictate the rest of her life, but the lives of Castilians for years to come.
In August, she made her decision and pledged her loyalty to Enrique as the one true king of Castile. She promised that while Enrique was still alive, she wouldn't make a bid for power. However, she demanded to be recognized as the true heir of Castile, stepping over Enrique's daughter, Princess Juana's claim. Enrique agreed to it.
The rebels who supported Alfonso were disheartened by Isabella's decision, but they laid down their weapons. After 3 years of bloodshed, the civil war finally came to an end.
Isabella played it smart. She not only forced Enrique to name her heir, but she coerced him into giving her land in Castile. And most importantly, she demanded that Enrique allow her to choose who she would marry, though she agreed to seek his permission before the nuptials.
But the reconciliation was, as always, short-lived. About a year after the deal, Enrique started having second thoughts. Much of this came from the whispers of Juan Pacheco, one of the Civil War's leading architects.
Enrique had forgiven Pacheco for his treasonous acts, and Pacheco, perhaps bitter that Isabella didn't declare herself queen as he advised her to, began plotting to turn Enrique against her.
Land that had been promised to Isabella ultimately wasn't awarded. Princess Juana was again being discussed as potential heir, and offers were being made to marry off Isabella without her approval.
But Isabella refused to let Enrique dictate her life. She was tired of being passed around for his benefit. She had maneuvered herself into the line of succession and would do anything to keep it that way.
If that meant arranging a marriage of her own, so be it.
Her calculating eyes turned east to the neighboring kingdom of Aragon. Isabella knew that if both kingdoms were united through marriage, her marriage, it would strengthen her eventual bid for power.
So, in 1469, Isabella began to secretly negotiate her betrothal to Ferdinand II of Aragon.
Choosing 17-year-old Ferdinand seemed like a no-brainer. As a teenager, Ferdinand achieved success in battle during his father's many wars along the border of France, and he also stood to inherit Sicily and the lucrative Catalonia region, one of the major Mediterranean trading hubs.
Meanwhile, for the Kingdom of Aragon, the Union presented the opportunity to finally stake its claim on Castile. For years, Ferdinand's father, yet another King Juan, had set his sights on the neighboring kingdom. A marriage between his son and Isabella would bring him one step closer to snatching Castile for himself.
But Isabella wasn't going to allow that. During the clandestine negotiations, Ferdinand agreed that once she was Queen of Castile, Isabella would rule with total authority, and he would be her consort or powerless spouse. And she agreed that she would act as Ferdinand's consort once he became King of Aragon and Sicily.
There was, however, one minor obstacle. Isabella and Ferdinand were second cousins. Because of this, their marriage was considered incestuous unless they received a dispensation from the Pope. And the current Pope, Paul II, was in line with Enrique.
As a workaround, Ferdinand's father allegedly bribed a bishop into reading a fake dispensation.
Isabella, a woman who was entirely devoted to the Catholic Church, had just violated Catholic law.
Not that she seemed overly concerned with the legal matter, because on October 19th, Isabella of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon were married.
Prior to their marriage, Isabella and Ferdinand had only exchanged letters. The days leading up to October 19th were the first time they had seen each other in the flesh. And it turned out, they got along perfectly. They enjoyed each other's company, and they became known around the court for their witty banter. In the evenings, both enjoyed listening to music and dancing.
Most importantly to Isabella, the union helped solidify her legacy of power. Once she became pregnant, her child would inherit and unite the kingdoms of Castile, Aragon, and Sicily.
Unfortunately, their marital bliss evaporated almost immediately. For starters, Enrique wasn't too pleased with Isabella's cloak-and-dagger wedding. And when the couple asked for Enrique's forgiveness, he responded by cutting off Isabella's sources of income.
Within months, Isabella's favor in Castile waned. Powerful families suddenly ended their support for her, fearing that the association would make them enemies of Enrique. Soon, only a few members of the church agreed to financially support the young couple. They had been reduced to charity cases.
Adding to Isabella's turmoil was Ferdinand's rampant infidelity. Prior to the marriage, Ferdinand had already fathered two illegitimate children, and after the wedding, the hormonal teenage boy refused to settle down.
Even after Isabella gave birth to their daughter, Princess Isabel, in October 1470, Ferdinand didn't give up his philandering ways. When he went off to fight in his father's wars, which was constantly, he was accompanied by numerous mistresses.
And as if raising a daughter alone and in near destitution wasn't stressful enough, the issue of the fake papal dispensation reared its ugly head again. Just before the birth of Princess Isabel, word of the forgery became public. Now the marriage was illegal, and the princess was considered illegitimate.
For a year, Isabella appealed to the Vatican, but Pope Paul II refused to help her. He was aligned with Enrique and was willing to do whatever he could to hurt Isabella's chances as future leader.
However, in the summer of 1471, Pope Paul II died, reportedly of a heart attack. Isabella knew that this was a chance for a clean slate with whoever replaced him. All she needed was someone to vouch for her to the new pope.
Enter Cardinal Rodrigo Borgia. By the start of the 1470s, 40-year-old Rodrigo Borgia had become a political mastermind within the Vatican. After being elevated to cardinal at the age of 25, Borgia spent the next 15 years angling his way closer to the position of pope.
Borgia recognized that he was going to need friends in high places when time came for his own bid. Originally from Aragon, he knew it was wise to create an alliance with Aragon's future king, Ferdinand, and his wife, Isabella.
The first thing Borgia did was convince the newly elected pope to grant Isabella her dispensation. In December 1471, Isabella and Ferdinand's marriage was officially legal. More importantly, their daughter was now considered legitimate, which strengthened Isabella's line of succession.
The next year, Borgia traveled to Castile and spent 3 weeks with Isabella. The details of this meeting are unknown, but by the time he left, he was entirely committed to her as Castile's future leader.
Borgia traveled around Castile and convinced many noblemen to support Isabella as heir to the throne. The pendulum of public favor swung back in her direction.
But instead of spilling more blood, Isabella wanted to reach an agreement with Enrique diplomatically. He finally agreed to meet with her during Christmas of 1473.
The reunion went exceedingly well. For nearly a week, the two behaved like an actual family. One would never have guessed that they had been violently feuding for years. Within a week, all of Castile learned that the royal family was finally at peace with itself.
After all this time, Isabella finally believed that she and Enrique had put their petty difference aside. He would name her queen, and the matter of succession would finally be put to rest.
Of course, before long, that relief evaporated. Throughout 1474, Enrique's health suddenly and mysteriously began to fail.
Finally, on December 11th, 1474, Enrique IV of Castile died. The cause of death is entirely unknown, though some speculated he was poisoned.
But the cause of death was less important than the matter of succession. Even at the time, there was debate as to what actually happened on Enrique's deathbed. Some witnesses claimed that he announced Princess Juana as his heir. Others said he refused to name anyone, and the lack of a final will made it even harder to determine who should lead.
The confusion provided a perfect opportunity for Isabella to make a power grab. If she didn't, Castile could slip through her fingers.
So, on December 13, 1474, in Segovia's Central Plaza, 23-year-old Isabella declared herself Queen of Castile. But if she was going to keep what was rightfully hers, she was going to have to stain the Castilian countryside with blood.
Coming up, Isabella fights to keep her crown and accomplishes something no Spanish king ever has.
On December 13, 1474, in front of a large crowd in the city of Segovia, 23-year-old Isabella declared herself Queen of Castile. Swearing an oath on the Bible, she pledged her loyalty to the church and to the people of Castile. And some of the kingdom's most important officials swore their allegiance to their new queen.
Notably absent among the crowd, however, was her husband, Ferdinand.
Ferdinand was back in Aragon fighting one of his father's wars against the French when Isabella crowned herself. And according to writer Kirsten Downey, Isabella wasn't in a rush to inform her husband that she was queen and he was king consort.
Even though he had agreed to act as consort prior to their marriage, Ferdinand seems to have believed that he could outmaneuver Isabella. It's possible that Isabella was fully aware of this and told the messenger to take his time delivering the message.
A week after the coronation, a messenger from the archbishop finally informed Ferdinand that his wife was queen. By that point, Isabella had already secured loyalty around the kingdom.
Ferdinand finally saw Isabella a week later, and a fight ensued. Ferdinand felt humiliated by the slight and believed that only men could inherit power. If she was queen, he threatened to leave Castile forever.
This threat left Isabella feeling conflicted. On one hand, she actually did love him, even though he was constantly unfaithful to her. And now that she was queen, their 4-year-old daughter needed her father more than ever.
Isabella also knew that as the first woman to lead Castile in 200 years, she would need Ferdinand's help. Since other kingdoms might perceive her as weak, having a man by her side would strengthen her image. So she proposed a deal.
To placate Ferdinand's vanity, Isabella agreed to put his name first on all administrative documents. This would make it appear as if he were in charge. However, actual power in Castile was hers and hers alone, just as power in Aragon would be his once he became king.
Isabella had an ace up her sleeve during negotiations. She pointed out that by insisting only men could rule, Ferdinand was creating a precedent that could threaten their daughter's claim to the throne. Apparently, that was enough to force Ferdinand to agree.
The timing of the deal couldn't have been better, because within 3 months of taking the crown, Isabella needed Ferdinand's Aragonese forces to defend it. Princess Juana, the possibly illegitimate daughter of the deceased King Enrique, had suddenly declared herself queen, and she had the Portuguese army supporting her.
In the middle of 1475, Castile was again plunged into war. Juana married her uncle, Afonso V, King of Portugal. Soon they invaded Castile and declared themselves king and queen.
But Isabella wasn't going to give up her power so easily. While Ferdinand went out and fought the battles, she led the war strategy. She demanded that they were to make war by fire and blood against the King of Portugal. One of her earliest decisions was to raid Portuguese border towns. But despite these raids, most of the fighting took place in Castile itself.
At the outset, the war was heavily tilted in Princess Juana's favor. Several Castilian nobles pledged support for her instead of Isabella. Plus, Isabella and Ferdinand lacked the forces to protect the towns that did support them.
But a major turning point came in 1476 at the Battle of Toro, roughly 60 miles from the border with Portugal. Though the battle itself resulted in a draw, psychologically, the Portuguese were defeated. Many soldiers, including King Afonso, returned home.
In the 3 years that followed, only small random battles occurred. It was obvious that support for Juana had evaporated. And in September of 1479, a peace treaty was signed, ending the war and Juana's claim. Isabella was officially the undisputed queen of Castile.
Now free to do as she pleased, Isabella decided she was going to do something many Spanish kings before her had tried, but none had been able to accomplish. She was going to go to war with the Muslims and reclaim the region of Granada for Christ.
In 711 CE, 7,000 Moors, or Muslims hailing from North Africa, invaded the Iberian Peninsula. The Moors firmly held power until about the 1200s, when Spanish kings slowly reclaimed their territory and forced the Muslims back to North Africa. The one strip of land still under Muslim control by the 1480s was Granada, ruled by the Nasrid dynasty, and it became a royal tradition for Christian kings to try and reclaim it.
But reclaiming Granada was also personal for Isabella. In 1453, when she was a toddler, the Muslim Ottoman Sultan Mehmed II sacked Constantinople and brought down the Christian Byzantine Empire. The fall of the city sent shockwaves throughout Western Europe. It was the last significant barrier between the Muslims in the east and the Christians in the west.
For the next 30 years, Isabella watched as the Ottomans easily made their way toward Rome. By the time she became queen, she feared that the Nasrid dynasty would ally itself with the Ottomans. If they did, Granada could be the entry point for an Ottoman invasion of Europe.
Taking back Granada wasn't just a holy war, but a preemptive one.
Tensions between Castile and Granada had started to boil over in 1480, with occasional attacks from either side along the border. When a band of Moors attacked the Castilian town of Zahara in 1481, some Castilians decided it was the last straw.
Before Isabella even had a chance to respond, a Castilian nobleman decided to capture the Muslim stronghold of Alhama in his queen's name. Their victory was enough to convince Isabella that it was time for war.
The war to reclaim Granada would be long and brutal. Isabella was fully aware that in order to succeed, she was going to have to be smarter than her male predecessors.
After several early defeats, mostly due to Ferdinand's impulsive desire to attack towns using only a few soldiers, Isabella and Ferdinand began to finally work as a team. Much as they had done in the war with Portugal, Isabella formulated the strategy and raised money, while Ferdinand commanded the troops in person.
But strategy only went so far. At times, war requires strokes of luck, and Queen Isabella knew just how to capitalize on a little luck.
When the Nasrid Sultan died, it created a problem all too familiar to the Castilians. There was a struggle between the Sultan's brother, El Zagal, and his son, Boabdil, for control of Granada. Eventually, the two reconciled and joined forces by May 1486.
Just a few weeks after the reconciliation, Ferdinand captured the town of Loja, and Boabdil was taken prisoner. Isabella decided to negotiate with Boabdil. She promised that if he were to overthrow his uncle, she would back him as the sole king. Boabdil knew it was foolish to say no.
In April 1487, Boabdil took control of the city of Granada and declared himself king. He wrote to Isabella to acknowledge their previous agreement and even promised to eventually hand over Granada in exchange for places in the eastern part of the kingdom.
Boabdil's uncle, El Zagal, still held a couple of citadels, and he refused to lay down his sword. But one by one, his towns surrendered to the Castilians. By 1490, the Nasrid dynasty was finished. All that was left was the capital city itself. But even though Boabdil had promised to hand it over to Isabella, he never actually did.
Isabella grew tired of waiting, and in April 1491, she ordered a siege of Granada. For 7 months, the Spaniards slowly starved the people within the city walls. By fall, they were ready to negotiate a surrender.
The terms were simple. Granada would belong to Castile, their Christian slaves were to be released, and in exchange, Muslims were to be allowed to continue living peacefully in Granada. And if any Muslims wanted to immigrate to North Africa, Castile would foot the bill.
On January 2nd, 1492, Boabdil handed Granada over to the 40-year-old Queen Isabella I. For the first time in almost 800 years, Muslims didn't control any part of the Iberian Peninsula.
Queen Isabella had done the unthinkable, and it was her strategic planning and Ferdinand's army that allowed her to accomplish what so many had failed to do.
But Isabella had no intention of actually letting Muslims live peacefully in her newly conquered land. They would be subject to the not-so-secret program that had been terrorizing non-Christians for years, the Spanish Inquisition. Thanks for listening to Dictators. Next week, we'll explore Isabella's role in the Age of Discovery and in orchestrating one of the worst instances of religious persecution in history.
You can find all episodes of Dictators and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals like Dictators for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Dictators on Spotify, just open the app and type Dictators in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Dictators was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. It is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound design by Juan Borda, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Travis Clark. This episode of Dictators was written by Joe Guerra, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher, and stars Kate Leonard and Richard Rossner. Hi, listeners. Before we go, I hope you remember to check out the new Parcast original series, Medical Murders. Every Wednesday, meet the worst the medical community has to offer. Men and women who took an oath to save lives, but instead used their expertise to develop more sinister specialties. Follow Medical Murders free on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.